For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, we'll be celebrating some of the voices behind Talking Books. On today's show, we'll feature three narrators. Tam Dean Byrne, the voice behind the books of Irvine Welsh. Stephanie Ellen, who possibly narrated one of the hardest books ever to go through the RNIB Talking Book Studios. And in a moment, Red Sail will be chatting to narrator Joan Walker about the fact that it's not just books that are recorded in the studio. And at the end of today's show, we'll join Lynn Livingston to find some new books in the RNIB Talking Books Library. But first...
Hi there, I'm Bear Grylls, and I'm going to help guide you on this epic adventure ahead. I'm proud to have you on the team.
High up above them, the spiders of Scuttleton Primary School were eating their dinner. Flies, flies, and flies.
Let's call him Charlie. On the outside, he looked like every other football mad boy of his age, but he wasn't.
Are we steady? Can we finally get going? Yes, we can! They all say. At last, the Burpee Bears set off for an adventure in the woods.
The Summer Reading Challenge is on. This challenge encourages children aged 4 to 11 to enjoy the benefits of reading for pleasure over the summer holidays, providing lots of fun as well as helping to prevent the summer reading dip. Each year, the challenge motivates over 700,000 children to keep reading to build their skills and confidence. You can choose any books you like to count towards your summer reading challenge. Fact, fiction, poetry, graphic novels, joke books, the choice is yours. E-books and audiobooks count too. The Reading Agency do have a list of suggested books this year under the theme of sport, Ready, Set, Read. Aiming to keep children's minds and bodies active over the summer break, empowering young people to forge new connections with others. Here are four books on that list available from RNIB. Spinderella by Julia Donaldson. Spinderella the Spider has a passion for football. She tries to play a match with her brothers and sisters, but she doesn't know how many spiders should be on each team. Even worse, she can't count the goals. Luckily for Spinderella, her hairy godmother has a plan.
Next morning, Spinderella woke early. She felt sad. I wish I could learn about numbers, she sighed. And so you shall, came a loud voice. Spinderella spun round and saw an enormous hairy spider. Who are you? Asked Spinderella. I am your hairy godmother, said the enormous spider. Follow me.
Spinderella by Julia Donaldson is read by Joan Walker. You versus the World, The Bear Grylls Guide to Never Giving Up by Bear Grylls. This book retells Bear Grylls' most extreme adventures in a kid-friendly way. He shares the life lessons he's learned along the way and how the skills needed to survive in the wild can be used in everyday life. From finding confidence to bouncing back from failure, Bear gives children tools they need to survive and thrive in their own lives.
I've been lucky to travel to some pretty incredible and often unforgiving places in my time, but none quite so challenging as the big adventure we call life. You see, as well as bringing us plenty of good times and great things, now and then it might feel like the world really isn't on our side. It can often get tough and rough out there, especially if we dream big. But just like being prepared for an adventure, we can prepare ourselves for the tough stuff that might come our way in our lives. And by being smart, we can often snatch success from the jaws of defeat. This book will help you do just that. I like to think of it like packing a bag of gear for an expedition, but instead we're packing a bag full of handy tips and tricks for dealing with conflicting emotions, physical obstacles, and mental challenges. As we head out, I'll be sharing many of my own stories with you, so you can learn how I've done things, both rightly and wrongly. I'm still learning just as much as you are. So, are you ready to find out how to survive and thrive and to never give up, no matter what's going on in your life? Are you ready to harness your adventurous spirit and climb your Mount Everest? Yes? Well then, what are we waiting for? Let's do this.
You Versus the World by Bear Grylls is read by Luke Brady. The Burpee Bears by Joe Wicks. For this bear family, every day is a new day. A day for adventure and discovery. And true to Joe's ethos, the book features a fun and positive story with added exercises and recipes. Join the bears as they explore the everyday ups and downs of family life.
Mummy Bear is snuggled up and snoozing under the duvet when one, two, three little burpee bears jump on the bed. Are we ready? Are we steady? Let's get cuddling! Then Daddy Bear sets off to the kitchen to make breakfast. Hooray! It's a new day! Bella says as she stops Baby Bear falling off the bed. Ray Ray! Echoes Baby Bear. I'm an astronaut! Frankie says. He zooms round and round the room, but then... crash! I'm so hungry, wails Frankie. I'm too hungry to be an astronaut. Breakfast time, calls Daddy. Yippee, says Bella. It's sunshine juice and porridge for breakfast. Frankie is still grumpy. I don't want porridge. I want banana pancakes with honey.
The Burpee Bears by Joe Wicks is read by the author. Also in the Summer Reading Challenge is Strong and Tough by Rico Hinson King. A story of hope and resilience, this gentle, inspiring book tells the tale of Charlie, a little boy who was taken into care when he was very small. Charlie dreams of finding his forever home to share with his sisters. Sometimes he feels scared, sometimes he wants to scream and cry, and he does just a little. But he is strong.
One day, a social worker told Charlie that two foster parents were going to look after him and his two sisters until a wise person called the judge decided what happened to them. Charlie was so excited. Finally, he would live with his sisters. But he was a little nervous too. When Charlie arrived at his new home, all his fears disappeared. It was a lovely big house with a huge garden to play in. Charlie had his own room and his foster parents told him he could decorate it however he wanted. And there was an excited, floppy-eared puppy named Belle. Charlie had always wanted a pet. But best of all, Charlie's sisters were there too. He ran into their arms and hugged them tight. He didn't ever want to let go.
Strong and Tough by Rico Hinson King is read by the author. For more information on the Summer Reading Challenge, head to summerreadingchallenge, that's all one word, .org.uk. For more information on the RNIB library and all the books available from that free service, head to rnib.org.uk and search for Talking Books or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. And now let's find out what else is recorded at the Talking Book Studios.
Now, it's not just books that are recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios, but also a wide range of magazines. Narrator Joan Walker will be familiar to many listeners for her brilliant work on both. During a break in recording, I asked her what she's been reading for us this week.
Well, I have just been doing the November issue of BBC History Magazine, which is a monthly publication.
And this month there's been a focus on the First World War, hasn't there?
As you know, what we have to do is a selection of articles because we couldn't possibly narrate the entire thing. So the selection of articles that we did this month, actually, for the November issue are focusing on the centenary, the end of the First World War, very much looking at what was happening in Churchill's world, the legacy of the First World War, not just in human terms, but also financial, economic and also in a sort of ecological sense as well, things that you don't even begin to think about. So massive agricultural requirements really totally destroyed areas, huge areas of land. Obviously, other raw materials were needed. So again, lands were mined for ore and, you know, fuels, leaving areas just totally decimated. It is a fascinating magazine, and I especially love doing BBC History because I learn stuff.
You've had a long career of working as a talking books narrator. Do you enjoy doing one more than the other?
I love them both, Red, actually. I have to say there is something sort of light about coming in to do a magazine, because it requires no preparation, because I would be given the magazine and the article selections on the day. And we go through and we check pronunciations, of course, so we can do our best. But we really present it sort of in that moment. And there's a kind of freshness that comes with that. But as you know, with an audiobook, with a talking book, what tends to happen, obviously, is that I get the book quite a while in advance. I can read it, I can prepare it, I can decide on characters, what they might sound like. And if it's maybe a series of books, which I'm partway through at the moment, I make notes so I don't leg myself up. I know what somebody might sound like, and if they have an accent, then that is sustained.
So what's the series that you're in the middle of at the moment?
I'm doing a series of what the Americans would call cozy crime, and they are following our heroine, who is a crime writer herself, but keeps finding herself totally caught up in ridiculous murders set in the Cotswolds. And, you know, I would advise never go there because people die.
It's a bit like Midsummer Murders.
Totally that.
What led you to the R&IB Talking Books Studios in the first place?
It was a very happy meeting with a fellow actor called Chris Scott. I was on the BBC Radio Drama Rep Company. Met this lovely actor called Christopher Scott, who said to me, have you thought about doing talking books? And in truth, I'd not heard about talking books. Obviously, I knew the R&IB existed, but I didn't realise that they had their own little pool of actors that, you know, they could call on to supply this fantastic resource. And that was 1988, so 30 years ago.
And something like 180 books later.
Loads. I think more, many, many more than that, to be honest, Red. I've done countless. My partner likes to, you know, add zeros to that and say, oh, she's done thousands. I would suspect, you know, in 30 years, I don't know how many I've averaged, say, you know, per month or per annum, and then times it by 30.
We've recently celebrated Catherine Cookson Week, and I noticed that you narrated The Fen Tiger, which I think is one of the top five books of hers that's borrowed from the R&IB library.
Really?
Which out of 100 books that she wrote is quite impressive, really.
Oh, I am delighted to hear that. I loved reading that. I mean, it's quite a long time ago. And as you know, she herself was from the Northeast. I'm actually from the Peak District. But I really enjoyed the world that Catherine Cookson develops and creates. And you can't not embrace the characters that she describes. And they're always incredibly emotional as well. I mean, sometimes recording books, especially where, you know, usually with hers, there is sort of a lot of human struggle. Sometimes people die in not always happy endings, and you do find yourself getting emotional about them.
Something that struck me is that, you know, she's far more historical fiction than potboiler or kitchen sink drama or romantic fiction. They paint a picture of a lost world, and rather in the same way that Dickens does, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. And she doesn't necessarily sugarcoat it either. You know, I mean, we know that she herself came from not the most comfortable background. So she doesn't really sugarcoat the fact that there was deprivation, there was hardship, people struggled. And, you know, relationships can founder because they do when times are hard.
Do you have a favourite genre?
Ooh, I have to say, I love fiction, and I, having read lots of the sort of cozy crime, it's not normally a genre that I would find myself drawn to. Personally, I wouldn't pick them up, But when I'm preparing them, I love how I get sucked in and try to find... I second guess myself and think, right, who done it? And then, you know, you do reach the denouement and you think, well, blimey, I never saw that coming. But I do... I love a bit of romantic fiction. And, you know, I also do love non-fiction because my background is science many moons ago. So I quite like those books that some people might not enjoy that are maybe sort of number-heavy or techie-heavy because I quite like getting my head around that and trying to make it presentable because somebody somehow wants to listen to it.
Which I suppose brings us full circle to your work on the magazines, BBC History, obviously.
Yeah.
New Scientist ever?
No, never, but I love to. I'd love to do that. One of my other favourites is my weekly gig, which is Hello Magazine, which is, you know, sublime to ridiculous. We do that every Monday, and I, as far as I can tell, the listener absolutely enjoys it. And again, we have 78 minutes. We make article selections. And it always has lots of glossy stories. It has a roundup of the week's news called 7 Days. And then we do lots of showbiz gossip and so on. And that in itself is a learning curve because usually, you know, there are stories that you think, well, that passed me by. Who knew? Who knew?
Well, there are many, many stories that would pass readers with sight loss by if you weren't bringing them to life for us. So, Joan Walker, thank you so much for giving up your lunch hour and coming into the Connect Radio studio and for all the hard work that you do on our behalf.
I absolutely love it and thank you for having me.
You can find out more about the many titles that Joan has narrated via rniblibrary.com. or by calling the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999, where you can also sign up for RNIB Newsagent.
Thanks to Joan Walker and to Red Sail. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. We're featuring some narrators on today's show, and here's someone who's narrated some of the more adult books in the library. Tam Dean Byrne is a Scottish actor and the voice behind all of the commercially available Irvine Welsh books. And he was recently in the RNIB studios, recording the brand new Begbie book, The Blade Artist.
As he elevates her skywards, the bright sun seems to burst out from behind Eve's head, offering Jim Francis a transcendental moment that he pauses to savour before he lowers the child. The hot sand will soon punish his bare feet, he thinks, turning away from the solar flare, and he'll have to watch she doesn't burn. Eve is fine for now, though. Her bubbling machine gun giggles, urging him to continue the game.
A clip of the as-yet-unreleased book, The Blade Artist, played with the permission of Penguin Random House and Irvine Welsh. The voice behind it, Tam Dean Byrne, joined me to tell me about The Blade Artist.
Well, Begbie is back. In essence, Francis Begbie returns to Edinburgh because his son's been murdered and he gets into all sorts of exploits.
Franco sets about trying to piece together Sean's last days. His first port of call is the flat in Gorgie, where his son met his demise. It is tucked down a sunless, tenemented side street at the back of Tynecastle Stadium. Canals of moss grow between its cobblestones and a deathly stillness and silence pervades.
Now, last we heard from him, he was being hit by a car at the end of Porno, which is actually soon to be seen in cinemas as Trainspotting 2. Where is he now?
It's funny, that comes up quite a bit. He's got a bad leg, definitely. He's been 8 years in jail, but he's become rehabilitated and become a very successful artist and has moved to California. He's been in California for 6 years, I think. He's very settled, married there, 2 kids, and has completely changed his life around.
Is it still the same Begbie, though?
Yeah, well, it's the way that it is with people. That's what he explores. It's like, can people change? Can people change completely? He certainly feels he doesn't feel connected to that Begbie again, but obviously once he gets back to Edinburgh,
It starts to have its effect.
Now, you've done almost all of Irvine Welsh's books. Have you got any favourites?
I think virtually all of them. They're all really so special in their own way. This is quite different, again, from any of the others. I really see the qualities in them all. I couldn't say. I mean, obviously, Filth is very close to me because I did it as a one-man show, which I've just recently managed to get. I've put it up on my Vimeo, actually, as well. People could have a look. I did the show in Canada, Calgary, and I got it filmed back in 2003. And I never actually ever saw the film get made, but I just got it transferred, and I put it up on my Vimeo page. And the whole of the show is there, and that means a lot to me. It's just each one that comes along seems to have its own qualities, really.
Now, when you mention Filth there, a lot of Irvine Welsh's work doesn't really lend itself to audio, particularly in Filth, where the words of the tapeworm overlay the words of the narrator. How did you work around that?
Well, what we did then is we recorded, because you can see the other words underneath, we did a sort of double track type of thing where you had my voice coming through as and now. Yeah, they managed it on that one. There's some others like Marabou Stark Nightmares. I didn't do that one, but I can see the trickiness that would have been in that. I think he doesn't get enough recognition for the quality serving, the way that he plays around with words on the page so much of the time, which is obviously tricky to be able to get across for audiobook. And I don't know what it would be like on Braille. I don't know how they would manage that. Yeah.
Now, I produced the RNIB talking book version of Glue, and I think I used about 6 actors on it, and you did that on your own.
I did.
How was it going from, like, Juice Terry to an American girl and all of the other characters that are in there?
I don't remember it being particularly so. That these were abridged in a way. That's what was trickier in the past, is that most of them were always abridged. I did more, the very first one back with Trainspotting, where the pair of us did it, it was abridged on cassette, it was way back then. But we did an unabridged version of Trainspotting just a couple of years ago. And we also did Skag Boys fully, and Decent Ride has been fully, and this will be, and that's what's great now. I'd love to be able to go back and do them all again, do the whole shebang. But, you just have to write it a lot of the time and then get the sort of, rather than just sort of thinking, you can't completely transform your voice, really, in it. Well, I can't really. So I just try and find the essence of the character in myself, because often you can relate to the characters. That's what's great with it.
So it's a narration rather than a performance.
Yeah, you are narrating, but it's sort of, you're also trying to make it in the moment as well. There's interesting sections in this one where it's Begbie recounting these circumstances when he was a young teenager, and it's all written in italics, and it definitely needs to have a different feel, but it doesn't really tell you what that would be. So I sort of tried it as if he was maybe in a psychiatrist's chair almost, or that as well, but he's reliving his youth, so it does have a sort of teenage quality to it. But you just play it by ear, really.
Now, the last time I saw you on TV was in Sky's production of Fortitude, set way up at the edge of the Arctic Circle. What was that like?
Oh, it was a lovely job, yeah, because it was 4 trips to Iceland I got out of that. And I got killed by, eaten by a polar bear in the first scene of the first episode, but fortunately they extensively used flashbacks, so I appeared in quite a few episodes. And it was a mate of mine, Simon Donald, who was an actor, who'd written it. I think he got me the part, really. It was an amazing piece of work, amazing thing to have. They're just working on a second series now.
And let's say you were a bit of a nasty character in it, and yet the next day you're reading Julia Donaldson books to children.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't make it up sometimes, an actor's life, hey diddly dee. It was because I'd said to them, look, I have to finish on this day, the 13th of June, I think it was, because I had committed to this, following the baton around the country, Commonwealth Games, attempting to read all of Julia Donaldson's stories to kids. And there was no way anybody else could do it. I couldn't pull out of it. So I thought, I'll probably lose this job. And that would have been a bummer. But they accommodated that and made sure they got all my stuff would get done. And so the exteriors were all in Iceland, but the studio stuff was in London. So I had to finish that day, and I had a really hardcore rape scene to film that night, and they had to extend and get me a later flight back up. But it was really, really was tough stuff. And then the next morning, I was in the Children's Wood up in North Kelvin Meadow, just up from here, doing Superworm with Julia Donaldson. Amazing.
And during the baton relay, I managed to speak to Tam on the road.
Well, in our marathon storytelling cycle challenge, we are following the Queen's Baton Relay all around Scotland and then going all across Glasgow during the Commonwealth Games, attempting to read to children all 195 books by Julia Donaldson and sing all her songs. And I am attempting to cycle as much as possible on this epic journey.
Could it be, or could it be, Stick Man? Come back home. Yes.
How much is cycling? How much is in the van?
Well, there has to be quite a lot in the van, otherwise I wouldn't get any reading done, because we are going big long distances. In a way, it'll be easier once we get to Glasgow. I'll do a lot more cycling then, especially because I think the roads are going to be a bit gridlocked.
Yes. Now, are you becoming very familiar with Julia Donaldson's work then?
Yeah, I mean, I knew it beforehand quite a bit, because she's been very supportive of a campaign in the west end of Glasgow to save what's called the Children's Wood in North Kelvin Meadow. And that was how initially I got asked to read her books, because she was supporting this campaign to save the land from developers. And then she came down and she heard us reading and that. She was very supportive. And then when the whole Commonwealth Games cultural programme sort of came up, I thought this could be an idea once I knew she had so many books. So yeah, she's been totally supportive, yeah.
Pull a funny face, move your eyes and nose and mouth all over the place.
So we're moving from the Gruffalo to Begbie. Would you recommend the Blade artist?
Absolutely. It's another amazing piece of work from an extraordinary writer. Yeah, totally, totally. I hope folk will enjoy it. Yeah, but it is pretty hardcore. It is.
There's another couple of kids that are mine around here somewhere. I don't know them. Barely knew their mothers. Michael's intense scrutiny of him never wavers. My girls, though. My sweet Californian girls, Franco says almost wistfully. I changed them without thinking about it. I always thought I wanted boys. If it's a lassie, it's gone back, I used to say. Now I'm different. I like girls. I don't like laddies. Good for you.
The Blade Artist by Irvin Welsh, its follow-up Dead Man's Trousers, and many, many other books by Irvin Welsh are all available commercially and in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB. See differently.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
Talking Books has two shows per day, one at 8 a.m. and the other at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime.
My name is Jim Broadbent and I'm delighted to be reading for Talking Books.
Enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library morning, afternoon or evening.
This is Julia Donaldson and you're listening to Talking Books.
And for younger listeners or the young at heart, Children's Talking Books is on every Saturday at 9, Sunday at 3 or Tuesday at 6 p.m. Books for all ages all through the day, only on RNIB Connect Radio. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. Now, one of the hardest books to be recorded at the studio was Duck's Newburyport, which is essentially a 1,000-page sentence. It was written by Lucy Ellman and read by Stephanie Elaine. During the recording, she talked to Red Sail.
So how is the recording of Duck's Newburyport going?
It is going absolutely brilliantly, I have to say. I was a bit unnerved when I was given such a long book, because there's like a map and appendices and things. So altogether, it's 1,030 pages. But my part alone is 998 pages. So that's about three times longer than any other book I've ever done. And also, a lot of the novels that I've done, and I think most people have, is, you know, you look down the page and there's lots of dialogue. So someone will say, how are you doing today? And then there's a return and fine. So as you look down the page, there's lots of white space, but not in this book. Every line goes all the way from the left margin to the right margin. So it takes a great deal of time to read even a single page of it. So yeah, I was a bit unnerved, but actually it really flows. You get swept along in it. So it's great fun to read. And yeah, I'm absolutely loving it. Because I know stream of consciousness things sometimes have a reputation of being a bit dull and show-offy, but I don't find this so at all.
Well, I remember when I could see, I sat down to try and read Ulysses by James Joyce, which is very similar.
The classic one, yeah.
And I found it incredibly hard work to concentrate through that. And it was only when, having found out that I was going blind, I picked up the audiobook version I managed to make my way through it. So how do you go about preparing to read a 1,000-page book in 8 sentences? Did you read it twice beforehand?
No. The book wasn't actually published yet. So I had to wait to be sent a PDF of it, and I didn't get that long before we actually did it. So I started reading ahead, but one thing about this book, which is extraordinary, is I've never read, either by eye for pleasure or professionally, a book where I had to, for pronunciation purposes, you wouldn't have to if you were listening to it, look up so many words and names. Because, for example, the woman in the book, she's unnamed. You almost can't use the word narrator, because it's not like she's telling us a story. It's like we're eavesdropping on her thoughts. We never do learn her name, because of course in your own thoughts you probably don't address yourself by name all the time. So it makes perfect sense. But she wasn't born there, but she's living in Ohio, and for a while she taught history, and she had to teach local history at a college, so she learned a lot about Ohio history. And as she's thinking about various things, she has a home bakery to make some money because they have medical bills because she's a cancer survivor. And she bakes these beautiful pies and cinnamon rolls and tarte tatin all day. And while she's thinking about this, and then these names of towns will suddenly pop in. And a lot of them have American Indian names. And they seem to be small towns. I'd never heard of them. So I had to find out how they were pronounced. If you just look it up in Wikipedia, they might have said about the town, but they don't say it was pronounced. So I had to look for videos. And then I noticed that, like, a lot of the videos, you type in video in the name of the town, and they were clips from news report, federal news programs out of Washington, D.C. They didn't know how to pronounce the town either, it turned out. And it was because virtually all these towns, well, most of them did seem to be involved in either school shootings, or they were sites from horrible massacres of the American Indian population by U.S. soldiers like 100 years ago. So it's like this is something that, especially as a mother of four, she's very anxious about school shootings. And this is always sort of on her mind. So then still, to learn the pronunciation, I had to find videos made by like hunters or fishermen in the town. And they would say sometimes they just photographed their guns or the water and didn't say a word. But when they would pronounce the name, it was usually a different pronunciation than the newscasters in Washington, D.C. had said. So sometimes there'll be a list of like 10 towns or creeks or something. And just looking each one of those up could take such a long time. But honestly, it was fascinating because I learned so much that I never knew about the country I was born in. So yeah, that's the main part of my preparation still, is that so I'll read about, let's say, 90 pages a day here out loud, and then I'll go home at night and I'll immediately start reading ahead for the next day and looking up all the terms. And she has an extraordinary vocabulary, and she's a cook, and her husband is an academic and a structural engineer, and he's especially interested in bridges. So there's all these names of famous bridge designers and all sorts of technical terms from engineering, amazing things about natural history. It's extraordinary how many words you have to learn how to pronounce that you might not already know.
Sounds like an education in itself.
It really is. It's funny because when people review it, they talk about the fact that, first of all, I find it annoying that they always say, a housewife in Ohio, and few reviews even mention the fact that she, as well as raising four children, which is no mean feat, she knows so much. She's had a great education, and she was a university teacher, and she has her own business of making these gourmet cakes and pies and things. I mean, there's nothing wrong with being a housewife at all, but they never mention that she actually is also a businesswoman. So sometimes some of the reviews I've read can make it sound a bit like twee, like it would all be sort of very silly thoughts, but it's full of the most extraordinary whirlwind of different thoughts, you know? Very intellectual to very sort of sweet, lots of memories from her past. It really runs the gamut, and you get very emotional because the character does, but it's also very silly and lots of fun.
And she isn't the only character. I believe one of the other characters is a mountain lion.
Yes, that's right. Another unnamed character. In fact, the book actually starts out about the mountain lion. Now, when they say it's one sentence, I mean, I think someone's done a search for full stops or periods, as we'd say in America. And I think maybe there's eight in the whole book. But they're not counting the section about this mountain lion. That at the end, there's a map, and it shows the mountain lion's journey from Appalachia all the way to Ohio, searching for her cubs, which got picked up by some do-gooders and put into a zoo when she was out hunting. So we start with the mountain lion, and I think it's all about motherhood, really. Can I read this little bit about motherhood?
Please do, yeah.
Yeah, so one of the things in the book is her mother, the character whose thoughts we are eavesdropping upon, lost her mother like about 12 years ago. And in a way, she feels slightly ashamed because you know you're meant to get over such things and not mention it anymore or feel it anymore. But she's so attached to her mother. She misses her so much. And when she starts talking about her, sometimes she'll get really upset. And then suddenly her thoughts will start listing things like baking powder, dried cherries, raisins. And I noticed this happened a lot. So it's like, in order to not get too upset in front of the children, she'll then force herself to think about other things. But there's this one bit I really like where she says, "People are just trying not to think about their mothers. The fact that I think that's all anybody's doing most of the time, all over the world, Mother Earth. The fact that everybody's either thinking about their mothers or trying not to think about their mothers. The fact that nobody ever talks about them. The fact that mothers never get mentioned at dinner parties, even though they probably cooked all the food. The fact that mothers probably invented dinner parties and cocktail parties. The fact that the world seems indifferent to mothers, yet when they die, it's so empty. The fact that mommy's illness broke me. Broke me. The fact that..." Now, who left their snow boots right in front of the back door for me to trip over on my way out to the chickens?
The distractions of the daily world, which, like the snow boots, just pull her away from being able to think more existential thoughts back into that mundane world.
Yeah, but in a way, maybe that's something healthy because, you know, there are some people that are so caught up in nothing but thoughts that they're absolutely separated from the life most people lead. And I don't know how healthy that is. I think she actually has quite a good balance of the thoughts she thinks. And there's definite intrusion of, you know, the modern world and our scattered attention spans now. I mean, they're full of song lyrics. And while she bakes, she's watching like really old movies. And so certain classic lines from old movies will keep coming in. And often it's because she suddenly starts saying that you go, "What is, oh, I see. She's now watching a movie," or "She's now driving her kids around," because she doesn't say, like in another type of novel it would, "She decided to take the kids to school." It's just by things she's saying and seeing out the window, you realize that's what's happening now.
And do you think that makes you closer to her as the reader?
Absolutely, because it's so incredibly intimate to share someone's thoughts in this way. Like, you have to know someone very, very well indeed before they'll let you in on some of their thoughts that are the kind of thing they may be even ashamed of thinking because it's not politically correct or it's something they may even be shocked by. You have to know someone really well for them to trust you enough or you to trust them enough to share those sorts of things. And we're getting all that from this woman very, very early on. So you do feel quite Well, I do. I actually feel quite close to her. I mean, I'm only halfway through reading the book, and I do think I'm going to feel slightly bereft when it's over because I care about her and the people in her life. And some of them I think are fantastic, the people in her life, and some I just want to shake.
One of the questions I get asked by audiobook fans and talking book users alike is just how long does it take to record a book? So you've got 997 pages,
98.
You said?
Yeah.
How many hours will you be in that studio for?
What I generally found, like with other books I've recorded that don't go straight from one margin to the other, is that let's say in a 3-hour session, I would generally read around 50 pages from the book. With this book, it's 41 is my average.
And is it odd for you not to have read all the way to the end of the book before you come to narrate
it? To be honest, it's really quite normal, I think, because we often get the books shortly before we're meant to read them. And well, generally, as actors, you often have other things going on, other recordings or plays you're in or whatever. So, yeah, it is quite key that you read, I would say, at least half of the book, if you have the time to, before you start at all. And of course, you must have read through the pages that you're going to do that day. See, in a lot of books that have lots of different characters in them, and you have to figure out how you're going to do all the voices and keep track of them. But in this, I mean, it is pretty much her voice. So that's something easy about it. But then, of course, there's also the thing about researching the pronunciations, many of which I have a horrible feeling I probably got wrong. Anyway.
And are you reading a paper copy of it rather than a Kindle copy?
I am reading a paper copy of it because it hadn't physically been published in this country before we started. So, yeah, they sent me a PDF of it, which is great because when I did realize I was pronouncing a word wrong, then it's easy to find all the pages that word was on and we can go back and punch in, if you see what I mean. That would be hard to do with a paper copy.
Well, Stephanie Ellen, thank you so much for giving up your lunch break to talk about Ducks Newburyport, and we'll let you get back to the next 540 pages.
Thanks very much.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. Now, some more great voices as we turn to Lynn Livingston for some new books in the Talking Books Library.
Firstly, this week we have SAS, A History by Joshua Levine, which was donated to the library by HarperCollins.
In 1939, Mick Gurman, a trainee engineer living in Wolverhampton, was nearing the end of his apprenticeship. Like millions of other Britons, he was following a carefully considered path which allowed for few surprises. As boys and girls of the Depression, his generation of youngsters knew the dangers of straying from their path. Work and economic security could never be taken for granted. Yet the world was about to erupt under these young people's feet. Before 1939, Gurman had never travelled abroad, and nor did he expect to. His life was settled. His expectations were limited. But over the next few years, he would find himself in Albania, Austria, Belgium, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, Egypt, France, Germany, Greece, Hungary, Iraq, Italy, Libya, Malta, Palestine, Syria, Tripolitania, Tunisia, Turkey, Transjordan, and Yugoslavia.
The SAS began as a lie, a story of a British parachute unit in the North African desert to convince the Axis that they were under imminent threat. The lie was so effective that soon a small band of men were brought together to make it real. These recruits were the toughest and brightest of their cohort, the most resilient, most dynamic, most self-sufficient. Their first commanders, David Stirling and Paddy Mayne, would go down in history as unorthodox visionaries. Yet this book tells so much more than the usual origin story of the unit and seeks out less well-known leaders like Bill Fraser, who was essential in helping the SAS achieve fame for their devastating raids. By looking beyond the myth, this book brings back to life a group of men who showed immense bravery and endured unimaginable risks behind enemy lines.
He rarely knew where he would be going next, and he never knew when or if he would see Wolverhampton again. Mick German's deviation from the path began when he joined the Staffordshire Yeomanry, a cavalry regiment, as an ordinary trooper. On the very first day of 1940, he arrived in Palestine, where his primary job in the area known today as the West Bank was to keep the peace between local Jews and Arabs. German spent much of his time on horseback, at a time when most British cavalry units had converted to tanks and armoured cars. Serving as mounted policemen in flashpoint areas was one of the few remaining tasks better suited to non-mechanised cavalry. "We thought we would be better off doing the job than the infantry on their feet," remembers one yeomanry officer, "and we were right."
SES A History by Joshua Levine is read by Dan Morgan, and it runs for 6 hours 59 minutes.
Kirsty Wark may be better known as a broadcaster and journalist, but she also writes books. The House by the Loch was donated to us by Two Roads from the Hachette Group.
Carson and Iona McMillan knew every inch of the 20-mile journey south from home in Ayr to the wilderness of Loch Doon. If they closed their eyes, they could track their progress by the pitches and turns of the road, the way their stomachs plummeted when the old estate car jumped over a rise in the road and then tipped forwards again. When the car veered to the right off the main road that headed south to Cusfairn and Castle Douglas, and they saw the tracing of the Galloway Hills in the distance, they knew it would be 10 minutes, give or take, before they reached their destination.
Scotland 1950s. Walter McMillan is bewitched by clever, glamorous Jean Thompson and can't believe his luck when she agrees to marry him. Neither can she, for Walter represents a steady, loving man who can perhaps quiet the demons inside her. Yet their home on remote Loch Doon soon becomes a prison for Jean, and neither a young family nor Walter's care can seem to save her. Years later, Walter is holidaying with his children and grandchildren on the shores of Loch Doon, but the shadows of the past will turn all their lives upside down on one fateful weekend.
The tall pines lining the single-track road to the loch stood to attention, like an honour guard waiting to greet company. Carried on the breeze came the protest of the cranky old engine and the muffled sound of unruly voices belting out an approximation of the Scissor Sisters song about getting jacked up on some sweet champagne. Inside the tangerine-coloured Volvo, the singing was accompanied by a timpani of wine and olive oil bottles and an old ice cream maker clanking together as the car bumped over potholes. Rivulets of condensation trailed down the inside of the windows, and the car heater whined with the effort of combating the earthy dampness, while the wipers tried to banish the misty drizzle. As the Volvo emerged from the tunnel of trees, it crossed an expanse of tweedy moorland on the way to the head of the loch. "Hey, Iona, open your window," Patrick McMillan called out over the music. "Look at the rainbow over Knockour." His younger daughter obediently wound down the creaking window with both hands and stuck her head out. She screwed up her nose as the rain, persisting through the arriving sunshine, patterned her face with its spray. She nodded eagerly, sending the beads of water that had settled on her curly dark hair flying. "I see it, Daddy," she said excitedly. Carson, at the other end of the back seat, rolled her eyes and fiddled with the friendship bracelets wound around her wrist. At 14, almost 15, she was 6 years the elder and had recently emerged from childhood into a tall, slender girl, her eyes a deep sea green, her face now almond-shaped like her mother's.
The House by the Loch by Kirsty Wark is read by Siobhan Redmond and lasts for 12 hours, 7 minutes.
Reader favourite Erin Kelly writes great psychological thrillers. We've just got her latest, Watch Her Fall, in the library. It was donated to us by Hodder.
It was 9 o'clock in the morning and already 31 degrees. London shimmered in a dirty haze. The weather reporter on the radio had said that it was hot enough to fry an egg on the pavement. Ava Kirillova thought about this as heat from the paving stones burned through the soles of her shoes, but she was not allowed to eat fried eggs and wouldn't have known how to cook one if she were. The stroll to work always eased out the aches of the day before, but today the sun blasted away any comfort. Sweat stung the crooks of Ava's elbows and the backs of her knees. A red bus sneezed a cloud of diesel that stuck to the sunscreen on her arms in little black globules. She had begun to crave the shower in her dressing room almost as soon as she had left the place she called home, even though the theatre was and would always be that.
Swan Lake is divided into black acts and white acts. The prince is on stage for most of the ballet, but it's the swans audiences flock to see. In early productions, Odette and Odile were performed by two different dancers. These days it is usual for the same dancer to play both roles. Because of the faultless ballet technique required to master the steps and the emotional range needed to perform both the virginal Odette and the dark, seductive Odile, this challenging dual role is one of the most coveted in all ballet. Dancers would kill for the part. Ava Kirillova has reached the very top of her profession. After years and years of hard graft, pain and sacrifice as part of the London Russian Ballet Company, allowing nothing else to distract her, she is finally the poster girl for Swan Lake. Even Mr. K, her father, and the intense, terrifying director of the company can find no fault. Ava has pushed herself ahead of countless other talented, hard-working girls, and they're all watching her now. But there is someone who really wants to see Ava fall.
The London Russian Ballet Theatre was a concrete block at the end of an avenue of thirsty plane trees. It was a palace of magic, a hothouse of excellence that looked, to the uninitiated, like a multi-storey car park. Today there was a splash of colour on its grey façade, a picture that quickened Ava's pace as well as her heart, until she was standing before a poster 3 metres high and 2 metres wide. Ava was reflected in the frame, her skin shiny as the glass. She watched her mirror twin's hand go to her mouth in happiness and disbelief. At last, she thought.
Watch Her Fall by Erin Kelly is read by Imogen Church and lasts for 14 hours, 22 minutes.
August Blue is the new book by award winner Deborah Levy. It was donated to the library by Penguin Random House.
I first saw her in a flea market in Athens, buying 2 mechanical dancing horses. The man who sold them to her was slipping a battery into the belly of the brown horse, a super heavy-duty zinc AA. He showed her that to start the horse, which was the length of 2 large hands, she had to lift up its tail. To stop it, she must pull the tail down. The brown horse had a string tied to its neck, and if she held the string upwards and outwards, she could direct its movements. Up went the tail, and the horse began to dance, its 4 hinged legs trotting in a circle. He then showed her the white horse, with its black mane and white hooves. Did she want him to slip a AA into its belly, so it too could begin its dance? Yes, she replied, in English. But her accent was from somewhere else.
If she was my double, and I was hers, was it true that she was knowing, I was unknowing, she was sane, I was crazy, she was wise, I was foolish? That summer, the air was electric between us as we transmitted our feelings to each other across 3 countries. Elsa M. Anderson is a classical piano virtuoso. In a flea market in Athens, she watches an enigmatic woman buy 2 mechanical dancing horses. Is it possible that the woman who is so enchanted with the horses is her living double? Is she also looking for reasons to live? Chasing their doubles across Europe, the two women grapple with their preconceived conceptions of the world and each other, culminating in a final encounter in a fateful summer rainstorm. A vivid portrait of a long-held identity coming apart. August Blue expands our understanding of the ways in which we seek to find ourselves in others and create ourselves anew.
I was watching her from a stall laid out with miniature plaster statues of Zeus, Athena, Poseidon, Apollo, Aphrodite. Some of these gods and goddesses had been turned into fridge magnets, their final metamorphosis. She was wearing a black felt trilby hat. I couldn't see much of her face because the blue clinical mask we were obliged to wear at this time was stretched over her mouth and nose. Standing with her was an elderly man, perhaps 80 years old. He did not respond to the horses with delight, as she was doing. Her body was animated, tall and lively, as she pulled the strings upwards and outwards. Her companion was still, stooped and silent. I couldn't be sure, but it seemed as if the horses made him nervous. He watched them gloomily, even with foreboding. Perhaps he would persuade her to walk away and save her money. When I glanced at the woman's feet, I noticed her scuffed brown leather shoes with high snakeskin heels. Her right toe lightly tapped, or perhaps danced, in time with the horses, who, guided by her hand, were now trotting together. I hoped they could hear me calling to them under the Attica sky. She paused to adjust her hat, tipping it forwards over her eyes. As her fingers searched for a strand of hair tucked under her hat, she looked in my direction, not directly at me, but I sensed she knew I was there. It was 11 in the morning, but the mood she transmitted to me at that moment was dark and soft, like midnight.
August Blue by Deborah Levy is read by Alex Dunmore and lasts for 4 hours and 17 minutes. And that's it for today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, there are over 300 episodes on the Read On podcast feed. Just search for Read On, the audiobook show, RNIB, in your favourite podcast provider. Or you can catch up at rnib.org.uk, scroll down the page and click on RNIB Connect Radio.